Welcome to Ordinarily Extraordinary Conversations with Women in STEM. I'm your host, Kathy Nelson, an electrical engineer who loves to hear and share stories of other women in STEM. Well, I'm always surprised at the number of careers that have an intersection with STEM and trying to get girls interested in STEM and bringing the awareness to the world about what STEM is and what careers there are in STEM. And today's guest is one of those people. Dr. Claire Christensen is a senior education researcher at SRI International. Her expertise is in education media research. She shares how the work she does intersects with STEM programming and the importance research plays in understanding and guiding education programming. Dr. Christensen has a PhD and master's in psychology and a bachelor's degree in mass communications. I hope you enjoy her story.
Hello.
Hi, Claire. How are you doing?
I am doing great.
All right. So let's jump in and get started talking about you, Claire, and SRI. So why don't you tell me about SRI Education and the work that you do there?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am a senior education researcher at SRI International, and SRI is a really exciting place to work because we're a nonprofit research and development organization. We have an education division where I work, but we have so many other divisions that do all kinds of really interesting research. Like SRI invented the mouse. I think they invented the .com suffix. They invented a robot who rides motorcycles, I guess for when you're too tired to ride your own motorcycle. I think it's actually like a safety testing thing. But so we get to collaborate in education with all of these folks who invent and create all of these interesting technologies. And it makes it a really fun place, not only to study educational technology, but actually to develop it too. And so that's been really fun.
Your background is education, but you have a BS in mass communications, specializing in educational media, and you have an MA and PhD in community and prevention research, minoring in evaluating education programs. How did you get interested? Because you have kind of worked throughout your career in STEM areas of education. How did you get interested in STEM education?
Oh my goodness. I have been interested in STEM topics, you know, since early childhood. My father is an analytical engineer in a field related to chemistry and always wanted me to kind of go into his line of work, working on scientific equipment and chemistry. And while I didn't go into that exactly, I was always really interested in STEM subjects. And at the same time, I was fascinated by media. So starting, you know, all children probably have their favorite children's television show. Mine was Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood because it talked to me about my anxiety in a way that no one else did and helped me to really understand my feelings better. But then growing up, I loved making educational videos specifically in STEM. So anytime we had a science assignment to do a report on something like, I'm not sure how or why, but I ended up doing a project about cyanide in like elementary school.
Oh,
and I would make a video about it. So I made a video with my Barbies and the effects of cyanide on Barbies, things like that. And I actually in high school got to do an independent study where I made videos for the kindergarten classes based on their science curriculum. So they were little videos testing out the scientific method. And I thought that my career path would be making like science documentaries or other science videos that they would show in classrooms. When I got, though, to my undergrad in television production, I realized that the aesthetics of television production, standing behind the camera, was not exactly for me. I had an internship where I had to take video recordings of sports. So I was doing like with the big screen that they have up at sports games, right? I was doing the camera behind it, and I would just follow the ball as it rolled off into the stands. And I was not the best videographer. You weren't getting exciting footage from me. And so I realized what I really want to know is what makes a video educational for children? What helps them learn from videos? And so I went into research to better understand kind of what children need to get out of media and how we can figure out if media are giving children the information or the experiences that will help them develop.
So I've been thinking a lot about, you know, how in conversations that I have with women that are in different STEM careers, and I mean, a lot with this podcast has really been getting girls into STEM, and the interest in STEM is very like top of mind for me. And one of the things, well, there's probably a couple of like facets to this, but I think getting mass media to portray girls and women in STEM fields, whether it's a primary character or a sub character, or just, you know, somebody that's is completely like, you know, some character that has no meaning to the show whatsoever, but they're like, say, a scientist or a doctor or just something that is like in passing, something other than a admin or a nurse or, you know, whatever the typical, you know, female profession is. But I think it's so important at young ages to see that. And I know that you work with like PBS Kids and things like that. What are you seeing in mass media? And do you think that that's changing? And how do we get more of that kind of programming and education to young girls? And I don't want to say just young girls, because I also like, I want my son, who's now 16, so he's probably like past this, but I think it's important for boys to see women and girls in those professions too, so that they normalize it when they are, you know, out in the workplace or even in school or, you know, whatever. What are you seeing? And do we have hope that things are going to change?
I'm so glad that you asked that question, because I am really excited about some of the new shows that are out already that depict girls in a range of STEM and STEM adjacent fields, and some shows that we know are coming out in the future. I won't, you know, give any spoilers for shows that I didn't create, but I think that there is a lot of media attention now to the idea of representing diverse people in STEM careers, not only women, but people of color, people of different ethnic backgrounds, et cetera. I think that this is a really great time for kids to be enjoying STEM media, because they are going to be getting so many of those different representations. It's certainly something that I wish I would have had as a kid. I think Miss Frizzle was my biggest STEM role model from the Magic School Bus growing up, but now there's so much more.
Are there ways that women that are working in STEM fields can help, not helping with content, but help, you know, have an influence? Like, what can we as like engineers and mathematicians and scientists do that work in industry or education or, you know, whatever area we happen to work in? What can we do to like help move that along? Or is there not really like much that we can do? I don't really know, honestly.
You know, I'm not sure about the capacity to shape STEM media. Of course, you know, if you have a social media presence, making it known when you enjoy a diverse representation of people in STEM and media can't hurt. But I think more than that, kids also really benefit from representations of folks in STEM careers in their everyday lives. Many of the measures that we use to assess whether children see themselves in science include items like, I know someone who is a scientist. I can talk to a scientist regularly. Sometimes maybe we don't think of ourselves as scientists, even though we work in STEM-related fields. And letting children know what you do, what's exciting about it, letting them talk to you about science and math can go a long way towards helping children to realize that scientists are everyday people. They're not just people with wild hair and lab coats.
For sure. So you had talked about being behind, and I meant to bring this up at the time, but you had talked about being behind a camera and doing these videos that you do. And I have to say that you are like, I've watched some of the videos that you've done, and you're like, you belong on in front of a camera. You're like very animated. Like, you should be in STEM just so that you could present, because I don't know if you've seen people in STEM present. They're not always the most exciting and animated presentations, but you're really like, you have a really good, from what I can tell, camera presence, and make your videos like very interesting.
Thank you so much. Yeah. One of the things that I love is communicating our research findings to the public, because we all interact with media in different ways, whether you know or care for a child who watches media, or you want to know more about how media can benefit yourself as an adult. We need to be able to share our findings with others. So one way to check out some really quick under 3 minute summaries of some of our research findings is to go to my LinkedIn. I'm Claire Christensen. I think you can just search for me on LinkedIn, or look at my Twitter. Research_Claire. I'm going to keep kind of sharing some public friendly findings. And we actually have a really exciting study coming out soon. I can preview that a little bit if that's okay, Kathy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So we often think about how media can benefit children educationally, but they can also help adults become better parents or caregivers. You know, if you're a grandparent, an aunt, uncle, babysitter, anyone who interacts with kids, media can help you too. So one of the studies that we recently did that we're so excited to be almost ready to share, hopefully by the time this podcast comes out, is a study about mobile messaging. So this is the idea that you could send caregivers brief text messages, really simple information, one sentence of an idea of something to explore with a young child. And we were looking at whether existing text messaging services actually have an impact on those behaviors for parents or parents' feelings of confidence and efficacy. If you are a person who cares for young children, you may have heard about some of these services. You know, sign up for this service and you'll get a quick text. You might wonder, is it worth it? Is it worth crowding my inbox? So I would encourage you to check out our report, which I will share on my Twitter. It's at research_Claire, C-L-A-I-R-E. The main finding is that, yeah, some mobile messaging programs can support caregivers' behaviors in a range of areas, including the way that they interact with young children. So excited to share more of those findings.
That sounds like something that would have been helpful to me when my kids were younger.
Yeah, absolutely. There are a lot of very time-consuming options offered to parents. You know, sign up for my 3-week webinar series about parenting, but there are often really simple things that can help caregivers to support children as well.
Well, and one of the things, like, I'll talk to other women in STEM and they'll be like, oh, I did experiments with my kids, or I did this with my kids when they were young. And I'm like, I raised my kids. I'm like, we did not do the experiments. We like, I was trying to like feed them. I was trying to go to work. I was not good about like any of this, these things, but it was not necessarily, and I'm an engineer, right? And I'm like, did I miss the boat on this? And so I think it's a great idea to keep things top of mind for parents, or like, you know, here's like little things that you can do with your kids to help them explore STEM, or, you know, what, you know, whatever the topic might be. I think having that is really interesting. So I'm going to have to check out that study, because I think that that's great that you guys are doing that.
Yeah. I love what you said about, you know, you're an engineer, you raised your children. I think that a lot of the work that we're doing and a lot of the focus of some of our collaborations with PBS Kids have been on ways that we can support caregivers in supporting children to learn STEM without requiring, you know, the big experiment with all of the supplies you have to go out and buy, and suddenly you have way too much of one ingredient that you needed only for one experiment. Instead, there are a lot of simpler ways that caregivers can engage in STEM-related talk with children, can talk about STEM in everyday life, whether it's when you're outside gardening or when you're cooking in the kitchen and measuring things. We've done some studies with PBS Kids looking at whether apps that encourage parents to engage in these really simple activities with children can help children learn, and can then the apps themselves can offer enriching experiences based on that. So the child might play a fun game about measuring in the kitchen, and then the app would give the parent a suggestion for a kitchen activity they can do to sort of build on that, to make sure that kids understand that the science they're doing in the app is related to the experiences they might be having in their everyday lives.
Well, and I had a podcast guest who, like, her experiments were like cooking in the kitchen with different things, because like yeast, as an example, is you put in different quantities of yeast or baking powder, or baking soda, and you have a chemical reaction in your kitchen. And so it's kind of like you're teaching your kids how to cook, but you're also teaching them science without them even necessarily knowing that that's what you're teaching them. And I think that, you know, I think those are great life skills that I just did not have on my radar whatsoever when my kids were young. Apparently some people did. And I had never really thought of it that way until I talked to this podcast guest. And I was like, damn it, I wish I would have like taken that opportunity when my kids were younger.
Yeah. I mean, but again, I don't think you have to set up some kind of elaborate experience. I think it's about how you talk with your kids in everyday life. Talk about, you know, counting how many things you're going to buy at the grocery store, or even just talking about your pets, how they grow, what they need to survive, things like that. It's just being kind of aware and intentional of the experiences that you're already having with your child.
And so I'm assuming that kind of like this mobile messaging is kind of like keying into those ideas so that you are having those conversations. Is that kind of the idea behind it, or is it something else?
Right. Yeah. So there's different mobile messaging services, but the main idea is giving parents any kind of brief nudge of something that they can incorporate into their daily lives, something you can do during bath time. You know, you could talk about which objects float or sink, and looking at whether giving those kinds of ideas via text message works. One thing we're excited about and think might be the future of this work is expanding beyond text messaging. Text messaging is so, I don't know, 2010. Now parents get their information from so many other places, Instagram, TikTok, et cetera. And I think it could be really interesting to do future work on how those other services inform parents' everyday lives, or maybe don't.
In looking at the work that you've done, so you there's a study that you worked on about Molly and Denali, about informational text, which got me thinking, like, I don't really know what informational text is. So I want to like understand that. And then, so tell me what kind of work you're doing in that space.
Yes, we're so excited about the Molly of Denali study. For folks who may have watched PBS Kids or know folks who do, Molly of Denali is a new show. It's about an Alaska Native girl and her community. And she uses informational text to learn about the world around her. So informational text is text that's designed to inform people. It could be instructions. It could be a biography. It's just any kind of text to inform, basically text that helps us learn about the world around us. And it doesn't have to be written. I think one of the things that we learned from Molly of Denali and her community is that text can also be oral. It can be information that is passed down from community leaders that can help us learn again about the world or who we are in it. And I think that this is so relevant to STEM because children need to be able to learn information from the world around them and from different sources in order to be savvy STEM participants in their communities, right? If I grow up to maybe vote on a public policy related to climate change, I need to be able to read my newspaper and take the information about climate change in my community to the polling place, for example. So this was a study looking at whether Molly of Denali, which is designed to help children learn about informational text, supports those informational text skills in young children. And we were so excited to find positive findings that children who watched Molly of Denali for 9 weeks showed greater gains in their ability to use informational text to get information than children who were assigned to not use Molly of Denali, to just do whatever educational apps or videos they wanted on a tablet.
Okay, so then I just want to ask a question about like YouTube, because this is like how my son gets probably the majority of, I want to say probably the majority of his education, including going to school, is YouTube. So where does YouTube fit into informational text? Would that be informational text, or like, where does that fit? Does it usual answer of like, it depends.
That is such a great question. YouTube is all things to different people, but yes, YouTube videos are a great source of informational text. So in Molly of Denali, Molly sometimes watches videos to learn how to do things. And sometimes she has to distinguish what's a reliable source from an unreliable source. So she might see one video that is clearly designed with scare tactics to get children not to go to the dentist in one episode, for example. And she looks into, okay, well, what are the indicators that this is trustworthy versus not trustworthy. But there can be all kinds of informational text on YouTube. And part of developing informational text literacy is the ability to critically consume information and find good sources.
That sounds like something that a lot of adults also need.
Right. I mean, these are essential skills. And I'm so excited that media creators are really pushing the field towards teaching all of these skills young. And it's not just media. They're also built into, you know, many systems of learning standards. I think it's really great that this is being built out. And it's wonderful that the research field is getting to participate by developing new measures. So for the Molly of Denali study, we were among the first people who developed a measure of children's understanding of informational text at a young age, when it's so important that they start to build those skills.
I'm going to assume, and you can tell me if this is a correct assumption or not, that that is going to be more and more important because, you know, like when I was younger, we had textbooks and we had experts and you relied on that. And now there's so much information. And I think it's really hard for people to find credible sources and know what's credible and what's not credible, what's, you know, actually coming from research and science versus like what is somebody's opinion, because everything shows up on the internet. And without digging into it fairly significantly, it's really hard to know where that information is coming from.
Absolutely. And I think that this problem of being of having so much information and so much access to information is especially salient for parents of young children. We have another line of research. We have an NSF grant to look at the content that is available to young children on YouTube. So whether your child is using YouTube Kids and navigating it themselves, or using just the YouTube website and maybe following recommendations to find videos, gone are the days where a parent could screen a few TV series and say, okay, Mr. Rogers comes on at 3:00, sit down and watch Mr. Rogers. Now there are videos from all different kinds of sources that children can click on very easily online, even if they are using an app that supposedly vets those videos, like YouTube Kids. So one really exciting line of research at SRI that we're doing that really builds on both my and our team's experience with educational media, but also our machine learning researchers' ability to develop AIs that can process video and audio signals, is a project where we try to see if we can identify what is or isn't the educational content in YouTube videos that young children watch, and how can we help parents to better understand what their children are exposed to online. This is such a new field of research. We know a lot about what is on television, the television set, but we as a research field know so much less about what kids actually watch on YouTube, because there is so much to look at.
I would take that a step further. So my son is 16. I would still like to know what he's looking at. This is going to sound kind of terrible as a parent, but I don't have time or the capacity to go in and like monitor what he's doing. And I'm kind of, just hopeful that the morals and values that I've taught him as he has grown up is informing what he looks at, but I have no idea. So I don't think it's necessarily just young kids too, but as they, are growing into preteen years and teen years, I know at some point you kind of have to, you can't monitor everything, but I honestly, I don't necessarily know. And I'm an engineer. I don't necessarily know the things that I should have in place to protect him from what he's seeing. And I mean, I do talk to him about don't put personal information out there. Don't tell anybody, anything about yourself, but I feel like I do a really shitty job of parenting from an online perspective. And I think it's gotten worse for parents because of COVID, all the working at home. And it's like, you just need your kids to go do something so that, you can work as a parent. And there's just so much and so much out there and such a limited number of hours in a day.
Absolutely. I think that you're speaking for many parents, and, early research on media exposure during COVID shows that many children were exposed to a lot more media. And I think that this is a context in which many parents can feel like they are failing because, and it's not their fault. It's that the context has changed, right? That children's access to media has dramatically expanded. And with it, many parents' knowledge of how to monitor access to these new media, hasn't increased at the same rate. I don't have any perfect solutions to this. I think one solution is more research about what kinds of media children are exposed to and how it can affect them. But I think another helpful lens is thinking about New America researcher Lisa Guernsey's three C's. That's the context of the media, the context of the media use. Is the child watching alone or with others, with friends, with parents? Are they talking about it? What time of day and what purpose are they watching it? The content of the media, educational, violent, somewhere in between. I have found videos that are both educational and violent, believe it or not. And then the characteristics of the child themselves. For example, as a child, I was someone who couldn't watch even the slightest scary media because I would become terrified for days. Other children may have different thresholds. And so I think that for parents, it's important to realize that screen time is not a monolith. Those, hour-long recommendations, 2 hours max or something like that, don't take into account the varied circumstances of media use and the fact that it can serve different purposes. And I think it's so exciting that a lot of new studies, including some work at SRI, are coming out that look more at these nuanced aspects of media use to try to give more tailored recommendations about the combinations of factors that may produce benefits versus harms from children of all ages being exposed to media.
I mean, you talk about screen time and the hour or two recommendation. I think that had to completely go out of the window with COVID because your school is all online. And my son would have a computer screen up for school. And then he would have either gaming or YouTube at the same time.
Yep.
And he would be on a screen from morning until bedtime. And again, I'm going to own up to being, I feel like I should have been better, but I don't know what else you do. And I don't know that I'm necessarily abnormal about that. I also don't think that it's healthy. I don't know. It's just, it feels like a very new world that's really hard to navigate right now. I don't know if it's going to get easier.
More media, more different sources will become available. And I think that this is a challenge that we're going to continue to navigate. And it's a challenge for the research field to move beyond those simple recommendations to better understanding. For example, when your son was using media, sometimes it was for an educational purpose. Sometimes it might have been for a social purpose at a time when your son couldn't socialize in person. Sometimes it might have been for entertainment, all kinds of different purposes and different contexts, and thinking about, you know, what is the relative contribution of those? Where do we want to intervene the most to have the biggest impact?
To the flip side of that, had there not been technology and screens to have during, you know, at least at the height of the pandemic, when people couldn't be around each other, that's the only way that he had to socialize. And mm-hmm. so would there have been more harm had it been in a time that there wasn't that technology available? People were just completely isolated without any type of connectivity, you know, whether it's virtual and electronic or, you know, I mean, it would either be that or no contact whatsoever.
Right. And I mean, students are even learning now how to collaborate on classroom projects, et cetera, using online technology, using Zoom and other video chats. We actually have another really exciting line of research, not my research, at SRI by researcher Naya Aloji, looking at how students collaborate online and how we can measure whether that collaboration is successful and productive, and how we can flag for instructors and others areas where groups of students may need intervention to better collaborate in an online space.
That was so almost kind of like a teacher kind of like monitoring and overhearing what they would be doing in a classroom setting if they're doing group work, kind of like that.
Exactly. Yeah. But allowing teachers a little bit more targeted information about how they can support those mm-hmm. collaborations.
That sounds really interesting. So I read that you are doing a study did a study with the Jim Henson Company. I loved the Muppets. They were like, okay, so this is going to maybe sound kind of weird. Miss Piggy was like my favorite. Miss Piggy and Kermit were like my favorites when I was little. What are you doing with the Jim Henson Company?
Yeah. So we were looking at a Jim Henson Company science property for early science called Splash and Bubbles. It's a show about undersea creatures who use the scientific method to explore the world around them. And we were looking at primarily at its effects in classrooms. So I think that one of the important things that media producers have realized is that it's important to bring media beyond just the television screen, to use it, to incorporate it into children's learning in different contexts. So in this case, the Jim Henson Company had created some materials that help teachers incorporate the show and related activities into their existing classroom instruction. And they were looking at how well that worked and how it could be improved so that they could better support teachers in the future. This line of research on how media can intersect with the classroom is really exciting, and it helps us to think about the many ways that children learn from media. We've also done some work with PBS Kids, thinking about how media can be used in after-school contexts. That's a really exciting setting because you can sometimes bring in parents and have them use media with children in a more facilitated environment where trained facilitators can help parents learn new ways of engaging in media use with young children so that then they can take those skills back home. And when their kid is using an app, they might be able to sit down and have a conversation about what the child is learning or how it relates to the child's daily life in ways that can really enrich any media use for a young child.
Yeah, that sounds great, because I think that at least one of the challenges that as my kids have gotten older, like it's hard to engage with your kids when they are, you know, they kind of have like their own world and their own media and things like that they're looking at. And I think it's harder to be able to interact with them sometimes. So I think that that's really interesting. What are you currently working on?
So we are currently working on some really exciting studies about adaptive learning. So you may have heard of adaptive learning. It's Khan Academy is perhaps one example that a lot of people have heard of. Alex Newton, iReady. These are programs that are designed to use artificial intelligence to tailor the learning experience for the child. So they may use, for example, a pretest of the child's ability to then plan a learning path for the child. They may also monitor how the child uses the system and then adapt the features in the system that are offered to the child. Oh, you seem to watch a lot of videos. Okay, I'm going to give you more videos and less text explanations, things like that. One line of my research looks at middle and high school students' use of an adaptive learning system to learn a range of subject areas, actually in China, which is a really interesting context because their use of the internet for learning is really exploding. And that's a somewhat more common context, using adaptive learning for the upper grades, especially in college settings. But some of our more recent interesting work at SRI for me and other researchers has been looking at how adaptive learning can support young children's learning. So we have a range of studies that look at children's learning from adaptive learning in literacy, I think primarily literacy, not only how it supports the child, but how it can, again, support the parent or the teacher in helping that child. So just like we were talking about with those collaboration studies, using adaptive learning to give parents information about here's where the child is struggling, here's where you could intervene, or to suggest for teachers, many of your students are working on this skill. Here are some activities you can do in the classroom that will really target areas where your students need a little bit more help.
Is there anything about the work that you're doing that we haven't really talked about that you want to make sure that you share?
You know what? I wanted to tell you about our Cat in the Hat study. Getting back to, you know, more of the science realm, we did a study of a PBS kids show called The Cat in the Hat Knows a Lot About That. It's a show that uses primarily the cat, who we all know from Dr. Seuss, but also a male and female child who are all learning about science and using the scientific method together. And you can find, I think if you just Google Cat in the Hat, SRI Education PBS Kids, you can find our report. We did it in collaboration with researchers at EDC. And the findings of that study are really inspiring to me because they showed that children who learn a skill, like a science skill, from using an app, playing a game related to science or math, can then transfer that skill to the real world. So that's something that we as media researchers worry a lot about, that if a child is learning a skill in an app, maybe they can only use that skill in that app. That's not good, right? We want them to be able to use their science skills in daily life, as we were talking about critical thinking or baking, et cetera. So for this study, children watched videos that taught certain STEM skills. We also had them use apps that taught those skills. And then we created an in-person assessment. So not only measuring their learning on the computer, but also in-person doing things like, can you build a bridge that's strong enough for this car to drive over? And we found that children who use those videos and games showed more gains at the end of the study after 8 weeks than children who didn't, which is really, really promising. It's showing that, again, digital media can teach us skills we can use in real life.
Good to know, because as I mentioned, my son spends a lot of time on YouTube. I could feel a little bit better about that. Okay, so what about from a standpoint of, like, do you do any kind of research on like gender bias in STEM? Do you do any kind of programming around that? Like, what are you seeing in the work that you do for, I know we talked about diversity in general, but, you know, from a standpoint of like boys versus girls, are you doing any kind of work in that area, in that space?
I wouldn't say that my research has particularly looked at gender bias. I think that the ways that we're addressing that more is by working with creators who are developing media that are intended to reduce bias in our views of who is a scientist and who can participate in STEM. In addition, as we develop machine learning models to better understand what media children are exposed to, we'll be able to look more at those issues of bias. So, you know, who are the people children are watching online? What is their background? What identities are they seeing reflected in STEM media, which can be helpful in understanding the context that children are exposed to?
And honestly, in listening to you answer that question, I feel like the programming, I think, is more important than the research, at least from my perspective, is, you know, getting that programming out there so that people see, or, you know, children see the diversity being reflected back in what they're seeing on media. What do you hope to do in the future?
One of the things that I am the most excited about is this idea we touched on briefly already, the idea that screen time alone does not tell us enough about children's media use. So what drew me to media research at the beginning is the idea that almost all children have access to free media, PBS Kids, other educational shows. Most children are exposed to media, and media can be a source for promoting equity. It can be a source for helping reach children with ideas that they might not otherwise have heard of. So for me as a young child, it was Mr. Rogers was the only one talking about anxiety. For someone else, it might be that a PBS Kids show is the only one talking about a certain identity represented in STEM. And what I am excited about is exploring the potential of media to have those positive effects and for whom and under what conditions. I want to break down this idea that screen time alone is what describes children's capacity to benefit from or receive harm from media use. So a lot of the studies that we're setting up to do in the future will look at the conditions under which children do or don't benefit from media use and the particular characteristics of media that are likely to benefit different children with different characteristics or growing up in different contexts, things like this.
Is there anything in the research that you've done that has been surprising to you or unexpected?
Most of my research is quantitative. So I'm looking at numbers, I'm doing statistics. What has really inspired me is the times when we do more qualitative research. We're going into families' homes and seeing how they use media. I think that based on the research, I maybe had some preconceptions about how all parents would feel about media or parents with certain backgrounds. And I think after you go to someone's home and you see the role that media serves, you realize it's a much more nuanced picture. You realize that everyone wants the best for their child and everyone wants the best for their family, right? No one's phoning it in a way. And I think one thing that inspired me is realizing that parents are using media for important purposes beyond the effects on their child of any given show, that parents may be, you know, using screen time with their children because they, as a parent, need a moment to collect themselves or to do an important task so that they can be a better parent later on in that day, or so that they can contribute to the functioning of their household. I think that that story, the story of the parent's experience of the child's media use or how media serves or doesn't serve the parent, is something that's been really enlightening to me and an important dimension of the kind of media use puzzle that we need to think about and research more.
In the research that you've done, have you seen changes from pre-pandemic to current pandemic to, I don't want to necessarily say post-pandemic because that feels like I'm going to like say something and we're going to go back to like where we were, but
don't jinx us.
Exactly. But have you been able to like document any of those changes, and or do you just see it in different types of your research, or it, because your research is different in different times, you don't necessarily have a way to necessarily compare that?
That's a great question. So actually, for our Molly of Denali study, we started this study right before the pandemic. Our first data collection was like 2 weeks before all of the shutdowns began. And then we had to transition that study to online research, which was a very exciting opportunity for us to learn about how you can assess young children via Zoom, an exciting and sometimes challenging field, but we're really, really proud of the innovations that our team, a collaboration between SRI and EDC, managed to make. I think that we weren't necessarily looking to see changes due to COVID, but we were interested to see that children were getting similar benefits at the beginning of our study and at the end of our study. So the children who started our study pre-pandemic got similar benefits from media at the end of the study, so 8 weeks into the pandemic, or maybe six, as the children who did the whole study in the pandemic. And more qualitatively, we saw that families and children certainly got a lot more comfortable with media use. So at the beginning of the study, we had parents hovering close to their children saying, oh, what are you doing on Zoom? And the children not quite understanding, you know, that they were on camera or how to interact with us. By the end of the study, those parents were so comfortable with their kids being on Zoom. They were like, I'm gonna go cook dinner. You do whatever you need to do on the Zoom. And the kids were so savvy with it. You know, these were young children who could share their screens or could solve minor technological issues.
Helping their parents with the technology.
Exactly. So we certainly, you know, anecdotally saw a lot of that. But I think that the important point of what we found during the pandemic is that even at this time, when children were super saturated with media, in some cases, there was still a benefit of exposure to educational media. Children were still getting something out of the Molly of Denali videos and games, and we could measure that benefit. And I think that goes back to the idea that not all media is the same, and that some media can benefit children even in difficult circumstances.
Okay, so I usually ask for advice for women or girls thinking about going into STEM, but I want to change that a little bit. What advice do you have for parents in trying to encourage their girls to go into STEM?
You know, I think I want to I want to broaden that out. I want to give advice to other women who are maybe interested in this line of work. I want to say that children's media research is the best. You get to watch kids' television all the time. My coworker Sarah and I often have debates about the meaning of a particular video of Five Little Ducks and whether it's good math education. It is so much fun. And I think that this field is so exciting and such a rich field for research because the context of children's media use is changing so rapidly and involves so many interesting factors. I would say that it's a wide open field for exploration and a field where we can really help. So Kathy, as you talked about your struggles with your child's media use, I'm sure that other people experience that too. And we need more good research that gives more nuanced guidance. And I think funders are interested in it. It's a great field to be in. And I would encourage other folks who are interested in children's learning from media to look into ways to join the field, join the fun. It's a party.
Okay. Well, I have to say that watching children's STEM videos for work actually sounds kind of appealing. Like,
it
does sound really fun.
Yeah. And you get to see a lot of the different ways that people think of to do STEM education. So one of the things that we're trying to do with our machine learning algorithm to better understand what kids are exposed to on YouTube is to make sure that it's not biased. So it's not saying only white male American style educational content is educational, so that we understand the range of it. And it's been really interesting to watch diverse representations of STEM, even just down to the vocabulary that people use, still accurate, still educational, but might not be on a list of key vocabulary terms on a curriculum. I think that there's a lot of more room for us to better understand how people from different cultures or backgrounds can provide high quality education and what that looks like in different families or contexts. One of the many exciting questions that we get to explore in our work here at SRI.
Well, it sounds really interesting. It's not really an area that I even knew existed until you came into my world. So this is really interesting to me. That this feels like, which I guess makes complete sense that there are people who do this. So,
right.
But it's not something that has been on my radar. So I'm glad that you're doing the work and I'm glad that you're working with the people who are putting together the programming that our kids are seeing and changing their lives. I mean, it's awesome. So thank you. And I'm so glad that I got the opportunity to talk with you and share the story and the work that you're doing.
Yes. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for talking with me. This has been great.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Ordinarily Extraordinary Conversations with Women in STEM. You can find a list of definitions, acronyms, and a fact check in the episode notes. If you like this podcast, please like it and write a review. And if you'd like to have more episodes delivered right to you, please feel free to hit the subscribe button on your favorite podcast platform. And please join me for future episodes. Thank you.